Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind. Until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
This show contains violent content and scenes of domestic abuse.
So when I got to Quosley, and she said, Dad, I said, wait a minute, Devin? Where are you? I don't know exactly where I'm at. What state? Alabama.
That's Devin's dad, Gene. In 2017, he received a call from Devin out of the blue. By this point, she'd been gone for 5 years, and no one knew exactly where she was. So Gene was desperate to reconnect with his daughter. And her call came as a shock.
She said, I'm on the computer. I'm opening up my own business, blah, blah, blah. She was selling stuff online.
Devin and John had started an eBay business selling jewelry, and things were looking up. They both quit drinking, and Devin says the abuse stopped. But eventually, John relapsed, and she says the violence started up again. So when she called her dad in 2017, she was in a really dark place.
And I said, oh, Devin, I miss you so much. You know, come on, baby. If you don't want to be there, let me come get you. I'll get in the car right now. Tired as I am, because it was late. I'll get in the car right now. I'll call the police, tell them to do a wellness check, and you give me an address, I'll be there. I'll put that stuff in my ways, and I'll be there.
Devin didn't tell her father where she was, in part because she says she didn't feel like she deserved to be saved. But she also worried John would hurt her dad if he drove down to Alabama to get her.
She couldn't tell me. Twice. And that was the last I heard from her until she went to jail.
This is Blind Plea. I'm your host, Liz Flock. How did Devin lose touch with all her loved ones? And how did she just disappear? From a young age, Devin didn't have a strong sense of home. She never felt tethered to one place. She lived at her mom's, her grandparents, and her dad's, drifting from one world to the other. In the end, she slipped right through their fingertips and into John's hands. This past fall, I went to meet her dad, stepmom, and other family members in Baltimore. And what stood out to me most were the parts of Devin that went unseen by everyone. The invisible girl searching for things her family couldn't provide. The parts of Devin that drew her, like a powerful magnet, to John.
Hello, hello.
How you doing?
Hi. Hi, Leslie. Hi. I'm gonna put this stuff
I'm meeting Devin's family for the first time. We're at her Aunt Leslie's house, which is cozy with deep couches and warm lamps and inspirational quotes on the wall, like good vibes only. As we sit and talk, more family arrives. Devin's dad and two aunts, then her cousin Vincent, her sister Simone, and Simone's 5-month-old baby.
I knew it.
For the first time, they are FaceTiming Devin as a whole family.
Oh, man, I should have called you. Hi, I should have called you. Oh, can you see me? I should have called. We got a house full of folks.
Hi,
I'm with your whole family.
Here's my little man. Hi, baby.
Oh.
Hey, I'm we can, like, buy it here and,
Is Fenty?
They're teasing her about the makeup she gets inside.
No, it's just, it's that dollar store stuff, but you make it work.
You make it work. I bet you know how to make a lot of things work now, yo.
Devin's daughter is also there, playing noisy games on an iPad. Gene worked hard to get custody of her after the shooting, and she lives with him now. Because she's autistic, she attends a school with specialized programs. Everyone says she's thriving there.
Hi.
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 Can you say hi, Mommy?
Say hi, Mommy.
Hi, Mommy.
I love you.
I love you.
Can I get a kiss?
I love you.
We got 5 seconds. We have 5 seconds. Uh-oh,
right,
three.
I love you.
I love you too.
We love you.
Afterwards, we sat around and talked about the Devin they remembered when she was younger.
My mom used to call her eccentric or whatever because she was so odd.
Really?
She used to always keep to herself and, like, go in the woods and talk to the trees and...
That's Devin's sister, Simone. When I saw Simone for the first time, I saw Devin. They've got the same round cheeks, radiant smile, and fun-loving laugh. They also both talk in this childlike way at times, like they never got to be kids. When Devin was born, Simone was 8 years old and over the moon with excitement.
Because I was like, yay, now I can have a real baby doll. I used to just watch her sleep all the time.
Devin's parents separated when she was 2, and their separation upended her and her sister's lives.
Devin came along when me and my ex-wife broke up. So I really didn't know her like that. As she was growing, I would go visit.
Devin's dad, Gene, is a beanpole just like his daughter, well over 6 feet. He used to play basketball back in the day, and he's wearing a tracksuit. He's kind and warm in person, but also the kind of guy who does not suffer fools gladly. He's pretty skeptical of me and my producer, Shanrika, when we first arrive. But as soon as he starts talking about Devin, one thing is clear. He really loves her.
I tend to be the most private guy on the planet, but I'm going to open up for my daughter.
Gene didn't spend much time with Devin in her early years. After Devin's parents separated, Devin's mom, Kim, gained custody of the girls. They moved 2 hours away to the Saratoga area in upstate New York.
In a lot of cases, the woman wins the rights to the children, regardless. So I accepted that. So I said, as long as I could be in her life so she knows who I am and let her know how much I love her, that's all I can do, because that's the only position I was in.
The divorce was ugly. Gene left Kim for a new woman named Joan, and everyone says Kim tried to turn the kids against them. Simone even referred to Joan as her evil stepmother.
Me and his wife don't get along. That's a whole different podcast.
Devin was more accepting of her new stepmom. She called Joan her steppy with affection. But things changed for the kids and their dad, who eventually moved 6 hours away to Baltimore. Kim didn't take the divorce well. She started drinking a lot. Devin sometimes writes about that time in her journal. She says it's a way of making sense of how she got from there, from what she calls her blessed life, to here, in prison. She reads an entry to me.
I had everything I could ever want and more, but yet I was lacking the one thing I needed most, my mother and my father. My mother had a good heart, but it was damaged, bruised, and broken. She never recovered from my father's betrayal. She loved me, but it was never enough, never all at once, never what I deserved. My father was the same, only able to show me when he would get me for visits, but even then he was more of the kind of dad who would be my best buddy, wasn't ever overly affectionate. I always felt alone, left out, not good enough.
Devin's parents weren't fully present. Kim was drinking, and her dad was building a life with his new partner. So Devin was sent to live with her maternal grandparents on Saratoga Lake in New York, not far from her mom's house. She was in first grade.
My mom pretty much was like, yeah, you can take Devin away from me because I'm not like really going to be like a mom enough for her, is how I felt at the time.
Devin's grandparents were attentive, nurturing, and provided a much-needed sense of stability. And while her grandmother was her rock, Devin's grandfather was the apple of her eye.
My grandma was like a saint on earth, but it was just like, I did something about my grandpa. Like, I just, that was my dude, you know?
Devin's grandfather, Alvin, was the patriarch of the family. Everyone always went to him for advice. He was unflappable. He just always seemed to have it together. And he was fun, taking all the grandkids to the amusement park and using his savings to build them a new in-ground pool. Alvin was also Devin's best friend. Her grandfather is the one who taught her how to spell, do her multiplication tables, and ride a bike. He always made sure Devin was dressed to the nines, in jumpers and skirts, like she was a little lady. Devin wanted to make him proud.
I loved him so much. Like, I guess I put all the love that I couldn't show to my parents into him, because like he was my parent.
When she turned 14, her grandmother passed away, and then her grandfather Alvin got sick with prostate cancer. Devin took care of him.
There was a moment, and I will never forget it, that I went to like help him, and I think I had to like change his bed pad. And he couldn't talk, you know, because the cancer just ate him up so quick. And he was grunting at me. And at first, like, I was like, Grandpa, am I hurting you? I'm so sorry. But he was like, it wasn't pain. He just didn't want me to have to do that, you know, because he was the strong one, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember that, and I was just like, Grandpa, I love you, like, there's nothing I wouldn't do for you. It's okay, you know?
He died when Devin was 16, and she was devastated.
I was in third period, and I remember getting, like, they call into the classroom, and I just remember telling my friend, please don't let it be for me. Please don't let it be for me. And I just had this gut feeling that it was for me. And when the teacher was like, Devin, they need you, I just lost my mind. I started crying. I already knew. My sister came and picked me up, and she just threw her hands up in the air. And I remember, like, falling to my knees in the middle of the hallway at the high school when she had to come get me and pick me up. And I just cried the whole way home that day. Like, when I lost him, it was kind of like, I hate to like cuss, but I lost my give a fuck, you know? So that's kind of when like things spiraled for me, because it was kind of like, if I don't have him, I really don't have anybody.
When Devin told me this, I felt like I finally understood why she was so vulnerable to someone like John. Of course, there were a lot of reasons, but losing her father figure was so destabilizing. Without a constant home and with low self-esteem, it was the perfect opportunity for someone to take advantage of, for someone to swoop right in. With her grandpa gone, Devin needed a place to land. Her mom was still drinking, so her dad was the next obvious choice. So Devin was sent to Baltimore. It would be the fifth time she moved from one family member to another.
Once her grandparents passed away, she came back to live with me, she was still good. I didn't see a change that much, you know? But I didn't know there was a dark side in her because she didn't share it.
In 2009, at the age of 17, Devin found herself in a new and unfamiliar world. The big, bruising city of Baltimore, which was so much louder and more chaotic than Saratoga.
I was so used to, like, disappointment, and I was always, like, used to, like, things being taken away from me. So, like, even though that sounds kind of, like, depressing, like, I was kind of just, like, I was, like, really go with the flow.
It was a culture shock, but she tried to go with the flow, like she was used to doing. Devin was starting her last year of high school. It was pretty scary to start all over as a senior. Devin had always been a good student, taking honors classes, making the dean's list. So her dad, Gene, put her in one of the most elite high schools in Baltimore, Western High. It's the kind of school where teachers expect you to get into a top college. Their motto is Western, only the best. In Baltimore, Devin was building new friendships and spending more time with her dad. But she still longed for her mom's acceptance, and Kim's drinking was getting worse. On visits to Saratoga, her mom got drunk and belligerent and said hurtful things to Devin. Like she would tell her that she was fat or that she wished she had never gotten pregnant with her.
Even if she wasn't the best she could be, like, she was still my mom, and she still had her moments where she was, like, really legit. And I guess I craved that so much that I took the bad with it, you know.
Devin went looking for affection anywhere she could find it. In Saratoga, at the age of 17, she lost her virginity to a guy she barely knew. She had been drunk and instantly regretted it. Devin was caught between two worlds. She was trying to be the straight-A, clean-cut high school senior in Baltimore. But when she visited her mom and sister in Saratoga, she drank and partied just like them. She said she was trying to fit in. But in trying to please everyone, Devin lost herself.
He would lie his way into their dreams.
He was looking for James Bond girls.
How fun would that be to be a Bond girl?
Then twist them into a nightmare.
This guy's done this before. He'll do it again.
Until a group of women banded together to put him behind bars and keep him there.
You have to participate fiercely, fiercely in what happens next.
I'm Keith Morrison, and this is Murder in the Hollywood Hills, an all-new podcast from Dateline.
Listen to Murder in the Hollywood Hills for free each week or subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com to unlock new episodes 1 week early.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
In 2010, Devin graduated high school. Her dad's side of the family came to her graduation, where Devin wore a brand new short-sleeve white dress. Afterwards, Devin decided to move back to Saratoga for the summer break before college. There was less pressure there, and Devin wanted so badly to be close with her mom and sister. Simone talked to me about their life in Saratoga.
They call it the projects of Saratoga, but it wasn't really projects, I didn't think. I've been to some projects, and they were pretty nice, you know. But there was just a lot of drinking and partying going around in there.
Devin met John at a house party at her mom's apartment complex. She was 18, he's like 24. John was commanding. Everyone noticed him.
If he walks in the room, like, he demands the attention type of person. Like one of those type.
Devin and John had something in common, too. Both of their moms would drink. John and his mom, Christine, lived just behind Devin's family. They were close. Simone said they called Christine their other mother. They made meals together, they helped take care of each other, and they drank together.
You know, we'd all just get drunk in the back little square.
In John, Devin had found someone who got her. He was white and Devin is black, but neither of them thought much about it. He knew what it was like to grow up around alcohol and to have an absent parent. Plus, John impressed her.
He was really smart. He was so smart. And, you know, I could talk to him
you know, in ways that I couldn't talk to anybody else. You know, because we were friends. We were actually, like, really good friends before we got romantically involved. Like, he was almost like my best friend.
John was often more handy than anyone else in the room. He could fix cars, build computers from parts, make furniture and jewelry. And he was handsome. Looking at a picture of John from that time, he kind of reminds me of Channing Tatum, with his muscular build and shaved head, except with more of the bad boy attitude of Eminem. John started buying Devin nice things, expensive clothes, flowers, candy. When he wasn't drunk, he didn't act like a jerk. He was charming, fun, and he was giving Devin the attention she'd always craved. While Devin saw John as a best friend, Simone felt differently.
I knew John first, and I was like, he's such a jerk. But she was attracted to him. He just thought his shit didn't stink, so to speak.
Remember, John had a lengthy criminal record. In addition to his alleged assault in jail and shooting a rifle into the air, he had also gotten arrested for criminal mischief for breaking objects in someone's house and spent a year behind bars for allegedly attempting to sell cocaine. Because he was wanted by multiple police departments, John tried to keep a low profile, so much that he sometimes did weird things around the neighborhood.
He's like sneak into the development because he was wanted by the cops. So he'd have to put on a little costume. And it was funny. He used to do that. One time he wore like a clown. I'm like, how are you hidden with the clown hair going on?
Clown hair?
Yeah, clown hair. Yeah, like a wig and some shades. Not like the colorful kind of clown, but like, you know, just like a light purple or something. I don't know. It was crazy. I'm like, what are you doing?
The clown suit was camouflage, so he could get inside his mom's house without being seen by the cops. It was unconventional, but it worked. As the summer wound down, Devin went back to Baltimore to get ready for college. She and John said their goodbyes and didn't plan to keep in touch. Because even though they understood each other, they assumed it was just a summer fling. A few months prior, in the spring of 2010, Devin had graduated in the top 10 of her elite high school class. She'd gotten accepted into a top Catholic college, Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia, which her family says gave her a scholarship to attend. She thought she might become a journalist because she loved to write, and she was good at it.
She graduated high honors, got into college virtually for free. She went for a year. She did good. And maybe, I don't know if it was a year. But anyway, she kind of started backsliding.
When Gene says Devin started backsliding, he means drinking. It's pretty typical for college students to drink and party. But Devin's drinking got bad. Intervention bad.
I was partying too much. And yeah, like, I was still going to class, but I was, like, going to class and I was still, like, drunk. Or like hungover, and I was miserable, and I wasn't happy at all.
She drank so much she got alcohol poisoning, twice. Both times she blacked out and ended up in the hospital.
I was just overwhelmed, and I wasn't mature enough, like as far as like being able to like make my own decisions and like. Being an adult, I just made a lot of poor choices in school, and I started partying, and partying became more important to me than my schoolwork, and I got a little out of control.
I went to the school. I said, I've worked hard not to make this happen again, but I can't control what she does. It happened again, so they booted her from school.
Devin's the one who called her dad. They met with the dean and agreed that Devin would leave school because of her drinking. Devin was fine with that because she felt she wasn't ready to be out on her own. It's rare that people are totally mature in college, but Devin felt especially unprepared and out of place. She'd only been doing college to please her family anyway.
And of course, I'm crying. She's crying. Don't be mad. I said, I'm not mad. I'm disappointed. This is an opportunity. I didn't know that alcohol was stronger than your life at this time.
I think that my family's expectations of me were so high because they knew my potential that they didn't realize what kind of pressure they were putting on me. And then the pressure they put on me, I put on myself even more.
Yeah.
So once I did that, it was just like, it drove me insane.
When I met them, I saw that her family was intense. They really valued education, and they had good reason for that. Jean and his sisters grew up in the projects in Brooklyn, and throughout their childhood, they were in survival mode. Jean told me that crime and death were all around him when he was a kid. He had worked hard to build a different kind of life. So Jean didn't accept anyone doing anything but their best. Devin, one thing she said is, like, my family didn't realize what kind of pressure they were putting on me, or, like, expectations were really high. Do you think that's true, or?
Part I could see that, because it was high expectations put on me. You always want the best. I mean, I didn't look at that as, like, too much. I mean, if she said, Dad, this is what I want to be, I would say, well, I'll help you be that. But all I said, just be the best you can be. Now, if she wasn't capable of being what I expected, that's a different conversation. But you're always going to have high expectations for any child, any person. I have high expectations of you, and I don't even know you.
Back under her dad's roof in Baltimore, Devin started to fall apart.
I didn't want to go out. I didn't want to do anything. But then it was like a counter reaction, because even though I was depressed and I didn't want to go out and do anything, not going out and doing anything made me depressed.
Her dad noticed she was depressed and tried to get her help.
I took her for psychological counseling. So at some point he said, I think she's fine.
She was not fine, but the counselor didn't see anything wrong. Devin was 19 by this time and a college dropout. She felt like a total failure. At her age, her dad had excelled at both school and basketball. Meanwhile, she couldn't even get out of bed.
There were some deep-seated issues going on, obviously. But I couldn't address it. Didn't know how. There's certain things she won't share with me, which is fine, because I'm a guy, so I get that. But so I never knew what was all in her heart, if that makes sense.
She felt like she couldn't open up to her dad. Not with all his high expectations. Jean didn't understand all that she was going through, so he gave her an ultimatum.
I told her that if she's not going to school, she has to work. I took her to jobs, retail stores. I said, I want to see if this gives her an impetus to say, I don't want to do this. I want to go to college. Because I said, we'll get you to another college. It's not the only college. And, nothing happened. So finally she said, I'm going to take a break. I need a break. And I said to myself, a break from what? You haven't been doing anything. But I ain't going to say that to her.
And so in July 2011, after talking to her mom and sister in Saratoga, Devin decided to take that break, to leave her dad's house and go back to live with them.
And she got in the car. She gave me a kiss and a hug. Said, I'll see you in a little while, Dad.
But Jean had a sinking feeling she was running toward trouble.
I said, okay, honey. I knew I wouldn't see her again. Now, like I said, that was the last time I saw her when she left.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's Be Human Together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
In Saratoga, Devin once again filled her days partying with Kim and Simone. She says she went a little off the rails, stealing alcohol from CVS and gas stations with her friends. One time, she and Simone got into a physical fight while drunk, and the cops were called. And as Devin began drinking more, Simone says, she rekindled her relationship with John.
She'd be over there at John's house, you know, and I'd be like somewhere else. I'm like, okay. We kinda relax, girl. We're getting too sassy in these streets.
As John wooed Devin, Simone saw more red flags in him. Once, he grabbed Simone's arm at a party so hard it bruised her, though Simone brushed it off at the time as no big deal. She did notice that Devin was becoming distant. They hung out less often because Devin was always with John.
Little by little, it was just like, I hardly seen her. But I would talk to her. I'd be like, Devin, you know, just checking in. Make sure you don't be leaving. You know, mom needs us.
Just like Jean, Simone was worried that something was shifting in Devin. That maybe she'd even leave Saratoga with John. Simone tried to keep Devin close. That New Year's Eve in 2011, Simone and Devin had made plans to hang out. But it never happened. Instead, Simone caught a DWI and spent the night in jail. When she got out, Devin was gone. Before John convinced Devin to go to Alabama, he asked her to run away with him to New York City. It happened that New Year's Eve while Simone was away getting arrested. Devin was 19 at the time, and she had all of the reasons to run, to make a great escape, to experience the outside world. John sent a friend to pick her up. Because of his pending charges, he wasn't staying at his mom's, and he didn't want to be seen there.
At first, I didn't think I was going to go because I was scared and I was really nervous. But once I made that decision, it was very impulsive, and it was just one of those things where literally in the middle of the night, they just packed me up and put me in the car. It just didn't seem like it was going to take me down to this path. I didn't see it being so serious.
Devin thought this would just be a detour, that it would give her some breathing room from her feeling of failure for a while, and that John would take care of her, that he would give her a home. But that's not what happened. As soon as he got her away from her family, she says, the relationship changed. In New York City, she and John started fighting. She says that's where John hit her for the first time.
It didn't hurt as much as it just surprised me, because I had never been hit like that before.
They were arguing, and then Devin remembers that she said something he didn't like, and that's when he smacked her in the mouth.
I didn't realize, you know, what I had done to deserve it, other than I guess I just ran my mouth. He was punishing me for it. And then, of course, the next day he was so sorry, and he was never going to do it again, and you know, and then maybe a week later, we got into another argument and it happened again.
He told her he was sorry and would never do it again. But then, Devin said, he did. Over and over. Then more sorries, following the usual abuser's pattern. She wondered if this was all her fault, that she was failing at the relationship, at keeping him happy, just like she had failed at everything. Devin said that as the abuse ramped up, John also cut her off from the world. She couldn't check her Facebook, couldn't make phone calls, couldn't go anywhere.
I pretty much had to stay in the room that we slept in all the time. I didn't get to go, come out, get to nothing.
They were living at John's aunt's house, and Devin says John didn't want her leaving the bedroom. She says she was surprised by John's abuse and control at first, then scared, and then ashamed. This all reminds me of reporting I've done on human trafficking. Trafficking and domestic abuse are closely linked. Devin's case doesn't meet the strict definition of trafficking. He wasn't making money off of her. But there are a lot of similarities. In trafficking, the perpetrators often do nice things at first, like showering a person with attention, gifts, and false promises, just like Devin says John did. But then the abuse begins, often after they've been isolated from their family and friends or any ability to get help. As Devin found herself sinking into John's isolation, those closest to her worried about where she'd gone. Devin says John wouldn't let her have a phone in New York. With her number not working, people tried to get in touch with her through Facebook.
I called my mom and she was like, yeah, your sister took off in the middle of the night. Da-da-da-da-da. Can't find your sister.
We didn't know where she was at. We didn't even know. And all I know is Kim was looking for her. So that's the only way I know. Kim wanted to know where her baby was.
That's Devin's Aunt Leslie, whose house we visited in Baltimore. Leslie says Devin's mom, Kim, really wanted to find her. But she never did reconnect with her daughter, because Kim unfortunately died of cirrhosis a few years after Devin left with John. Simone kept trying to find Devin, too. She posted to Devin's Facebook page throughout 2012, trying different tactics to get Devin to respond.
Hey, bitch. I can't wait to have you in my life.
Hey, Dev, just dropping a line. I miss you.
Hey, Dev, I'm going to punch you in the neck. Hope you ain't in some sort of trouble. Pick up the phone and call. Devin, Marie, holla at me. Love you so much. Come on, Dev. This shit is getting ridiculous.
She got angry, warning her sister not to abandon their mom. At one point, Simone even posted to Devin's page that she was getting married.
Oh, by the way, I'm getting married and you're invited, so call me.
And still, nothing. No reply. Simone suspected Devin may have run away with John, so she kept asking John's mom, Christine, if she knew where they went. But she says Christine told her no. Devin's best friend, Kira, also noticed something was off.
The brother of my neighbor, he passed away. So I reached out to let her know that, and she didn't respond. And I'm like, okay, no, something's off because she would care about this. But she didn't have access to the internet at that point. And when I realized like something was wrong, I went back to her Facebook and saw her family posting, like trying to get her to reach out to them. And I'm like, oh, so she cut everybody off. What the hell's going on? I'm also that FBI friend. If you need to find someone, I can. But I couldn't find her anywhere, which concerned the hell out of me because it's not difficult for me to do that. But I couldn't find anything.
Over the years, her friends and family continued to post to her Facebook page. No one knew she was in Alabama.
Does she have a new Facebook? I've been trying to.
If any of Devin Gray's friends see this.
Call me, darling. I will come and get you no matter where. Auntie loves you to the moon and beyond.
When I asked Devin's family in Baltimore about when she disappeared, I was surprised to learn that no one filed a missing persons report. But they told me they didn't think the cops could or would do anything. And for good reason. Even though Black girls go missing at a disproportionate rate to white girls, they typically get less attention from the cops and the media. Police also wrongly categorize many missing Black girl cases as runaways, when really they are the victims of abuse or trafficking, or worse. As for Devin, she was now over 18, and her family had a feeling she might not want to be found. And you might be thinking, her family still could have done more to find her. But what were they supposed to do exactly? Devin said John was good at making sure she was never reachable for long. When I talked to her family, it was clear that this was a sore subject for them, especially her dad, Gene. He felt like he couldn't do anything about his daughter totally disappearing, that he had no control.
Liz, I'm gonna say this again.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I keep asking you.
It's the same question different ways.
Yeah.
Like a lawyer. So,
this is
the thing. There was a lot of things I did not know.
Yeah.
But when a child is 18, you can't stop them. Or I get arrested for abduction. So, go ahead, honey. If you feel like you need a break, go ahead. See you when you get back.
Yeah.
I knew there was trouble. Come on. People tend to run the trouble sometimes.
At some points while we talked, Gene seemed to blame Devin. At other points, he blamed himself.
As a dad, you always want to protect your children. And I couldn't protect her because I didn't know where she was.
It was like all these years later, he still didn't know how to feel.
How can you find someone? How can, when Alabama's not like, itty bitty USA. Yeah, the state of Alabama. How can you find someone where you don't have no idea where they are? And she didn't even call me to tell me she was okay.
I was like kind of angry inside for her just not trying to reach out secretly, you know, secretly grab the phone and call. And
like, I pretty much grieved her at that point because I didn't think she was coming back.
Although Devin had a phone in Alabama, she says John monitored her communications and repeatedly warned her not to contact her family. So Devin didn't for years. But then in 2017, Devin made a call to her dad, Gene, the phone call you heard about at the start of this episode. It had been 5 years since the last time they spoke. Gene says she sounded drunk on the call. At this point in Alabama, Devin was isolated, only sleeping a few hours a night, having nightmares and not leaving the house.
So I said, I'll come get you. No, Dad, no. Leslie told me we both go get her. I said, Devin, you drinking now. I can't talk to you like this. I want to help you, but you don't want my help. So I hung up. She called back. I said, Devin, I need to come get you, baby, because you wouldn't call me if you weren't happy.
Devin dialed *68 before calling her dad so that he couldn't call her back. Gene got a couple more calls from Devin over the next few months, but the calls were always brief and always cryptic. After one of the calls, she says, John found out what she had done and beat her. She told me it was worth it to hear her dad's voice. One time, she forgot to dial *68. Gene called her back immediately. John saw the call and got angry, she says. Shortly after that, Devin says John changed her number, and then no one could reach her again. Except there was one person who Devin confided in, and that person was John's mom, Christine. All the while, as Devin says John became more controlling, Devin stayed in contact with Christine. They would talk on the phone all the time.
I actually called her while I was in the detective's car. She was the first person I called, and I just said, I'm so sorry. She's like, oh my God, I knew this was gonna happen. I should have got you the baby out. Like, she was like remorseful.
The morning of December 12th, 2017, as Devin was still processing what had happened, she made a call to Christine to tell her that her son was dead. To tell her she was the one who had killed him. She felt like Christine might understand because she says Christine witnessed the abuse. That's next time on Blind Plea.
I think my son has always been attracted to girls who are needing to be saved.
Who was John Henry Vance? We'll unpack the boy from Alabama and the man who was killed, and we'll meet the woman who raised him, Christine.
And if it is at the point that my son is putting his hands on you, get the fuck out of there.
If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse, use a safe computer and contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233. There's more Blind Plea with Lemonada Premium. Subscribers get exclusive access to bonus content, like an interview with John's dad, Henry, and more excerpts from Devin's detective interview the night of the shooting. Subscribe now in Apple Podcasts. Blind Plea is a production of Lemonada Media. I'm your host, Liz Flock. This episode was produced by Shenrika Evans. Hannah Boomershine and Rachel Pilgrim are also our producers. Kristen Lepore is our senior producer. Tony Williams is our associate producer. Story editing by Martina Abrahams Ilunga. Mix, music, and sound design by Andrea Kristen's daughter, with additional mixing and engineering from Ivan Kurayev. Naomi Barr is our fact checker. Jayla Everett is our production intern. Jackie Danziger is our vice president of narrative content. Executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax, Jessica Cordova-Kramer, Evoke Media, and Sabrina Mirage-Naim, and myself, Liz Flock. This series was co-created with Evoke Media and presented by Marguerite Casey Foundation. Help others find our show by leaving us a rating and writing a review. Follow me at Liz Flock. And for more stories of women and self-defense, check out my book, The Furies, from Harper Books, available for pre-order now. Find Lemonada at Lemonada Media across all social platforms. And follow Blind Plea wherever you get your podcasts, or listen ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership. Thanks so much for listening.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Feeling decision fatigue about what to make for dinner? We get it. I'm Jane Black.
And I'm Liz Dunn. We're veteran food journalists, and as parents ourselves, we know how hard it can be to feed your family.
That's why we created Pressure Cooker, a podcast that offers practical strategies for navigating the marketing madness and cultural expectations around mealtime.
Each week, we'll check in with the experts. From social media diet trends to baby-led weaning and AI meal planning, we have all your food-related questions covered.
Listen to Pressure Cooker wherever you get your podcasts.